11. A world without borders. The United Nations once dealt only with governments, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan mused in 2005. By now we know that peace and prosperity cannot be achieved without partnerships involving governments, international organizations, the business community, and civil society. In today's world, we depend on each other. Annan went a step further by concluding that, in the age of interdependence, global citizenship is a crucial pillar of progress. But progress, in Secretary General Annan's perspective, would demand the destruction of national sovereignty to make room for the creation of a borderless global civil society. World governance would be doled out by a massive, faceless international bureaucracy, which would disrespect liberty and relegate individuals to the status of worker ants in a socialist authoritarian universe. In Annan's utopia, world citizenship, or democracy from the bottom up, and regional and global supranational institutions would be added to a witch's brew of leftist propaganda and direct action designed to make people believe that the 500-year-old concept of national sovereignty is hopelessly outmoded in the underlying cause of war. The hard left creates a false image that depicts sovereignty, the nation-state, and peace and war through the selective use of truth. The fragments of truth used today to make a paste of sovereignty is the ultra-left's argument that the inability of nation-states to establish a lasting peace and protect human rights illustrates a failure of mankind. If the sovereign state is the cause of war, the advocates of a UN-oriented global governance say, then one should eliminate sovereignty and replace it with a world without borders, supplant national citizenship with global citizenship, and create international institutions, such as the International Criminal Court, to deal with violations of a world code of justice. H. G. Wells, among those of his time in the early 1920s who were shattered by the carnage of the Great War, closed his renowned work The Outline of History with a speculation about the world government evolving over time. A major weakness he found in the League of Nations was its structural deference to sovereignty and emphasis on nationality, when just the opposite focus was needed. The world perishes unless sovereignty is merged and nationality subordinated, Mr. Wells opined. And for that the minds of men must first be prepared by experience and knowledge and thought, he said. The supreme task before men at the present time is political education. Hitler, Stalin, Mao, and lesser demons of the 20th century tried to re-educate the people to embrace their own versions of a socialist fantasy world, enforcing political education by the power of the gun. Individual liberty and the thirst for freedom, however, withstood the best of the fascist and communist efforts to create new citizens, despite their killing of millions. The United Nations under Kofi Annan and his acolytes brushed this recent history aside in a program of agitation and propaganda masked as an education project. The UN's Teaching Toward a Culture of Peace program was organized and is directed by the ultra-left that would destroy sovereignty of the nation-state to make way for a global governance through authoritarian socialist world without borders. The revisionist Marxist ideas of Antonio Gramsci from the 1930s were picked up and rolled around in the United States and Western Europe during the 1960s and 1970s, when traditional values and appreciation of heritage were challenged and re-examined by the new left. Gramsci's ideas did not disappear. Many of his exponents found their way into the academy where they toiled at political education in order to change the values of society and the people's understanding of their heritage, both of which served as guideposts for contemporary life. Hence, we discover in the early 21st century that the seeds of change that would destroy sovereignty in favor of socialist authoritarianism are upon us once again. The challenge against sovereignty and for a world without borders is manifested largely through the United Nations. As Marxist renewal and reemergence evolved from the pit through the 1990s, the hard left visionaries drove home their key propaganda points: the global environment, human rights, and world peace, as a part of their overall message of global justice and citizenship. The United Nations behind the United Nations. Dorgold's 2004 report Tower of Babel and Joseph Klein's 2005 Global Deception together do an excellent job of exposing some of the UN's most monumental failings and persistent weaknesses, especially those cropping up since the early 1990s. Former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations Dorgold finds the world body to be an abject failure and dominated by anti-Western forces, dictatorships, state sponsors of terrorism, and America's worst enemies. Betraying the noble ideals of the UN's founders, Gold argues, the organization lost its moral clarity and had proven unable to confront aggression effectively, preserve international peace, and defend human rights. As supporting evidence, Ambassador Gold notes that barely an eyebrow was raised at the UN during the 1970s when millions were slaughtered in Cambodia and Uganda, and 1994 United Nations peacekeeping forces maintained strict impartiality, while 980,000 Rwandan Tutsis were slaughtered, in 1995 when 7,000 Bosnian Muslims were murdered by Serb military forces after having been lured into a UN safe haven, and another 40,000 deported to other areas of Bosnia, and in 1998, when five African countries invaded the Democratic Republic of the Congo to plunder its plentiful natural resources wealth, the UN sent a small observer force while 2.5 million people were being killed over the next 3 years. The end of the Cold War brought the world a new UN majority consisting of dictatorships, terrorist-supporting countries, and those controlled or advised by America-hating revolutionary socialist states. Secretary General Kofi Annan used the confusion of transition at the UN to undermine nation-state sovereignty in favor of using key advisors and NGOs as tools to advance his global governance agenda. In the process, the UN was emptied of moral clarity. By 2008, the world's focus shifted to Darfur, Sudan's troubled region, where more than 300,000 people had been killed, mostly black Christians, and another 2 or 3 million driven from their homes over a five-year period. The UN once again showed itself unable and or unwilling to respond to the needs, in columnist Nat Hentoff's words, of the innocent people in Darfur. Gold's indictment was peppered with value-neutral, diplomatic neutralism, moral equivalence, moral relativism, and similar words and phrases. But his well-grounded argument uses words as lashes in what can best be described in his observations that the UN ethos has shifted and that it uses impartiality as a guiding principle, which is then stood on its head by misapplying it to mean make no moral judgments. To be impartial means not to take sides while protecting both antagonists. By doing nothing to stop aggression, the UN puts itself on the side of genocidal violence. Ambassador Gold concludes that the UN is protected by a very high wall of political correctness that makes criticism of it tantamount to an attack on all mankind. But it is time to recognize that it has utterly failed to achieve its founders' goals, to halt aggression and assure world order. The UN has proven itself to be singularly unsuited to preserving global order. The organization's record over the past half century reflects one shocking failure after another. The 1990s brought the UN's flaws into sharper focus, and they have only grown more glaring in recent years. Joseph Klein's critique of the contemporary UN takes a different tack, but is no less realistic and demanding in its appraisal. For Klein, the real threat posed by the UN was spawned from its globalist ideology that has corrupted its founders' original intentions. The globalist goal, Klein explains, is to neuter the United States Constitution and the nation it defines. To those ends, powerful, pervasive, and progressive ideologies have led it, the UN, astray. In January 2008, Joseph Klein said that UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was certainly a big improvement over his predecessor, Kofi Annan, noting his quiet diplomacy on issues associated with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But, insofar as the institution is concerned, Klein writes, the United Nations continues to spiral downward. Klein cited the lack of progress in Darfur, where mass killings of non-Arabs were continuing at genocidal rates. These events unfolding before the world's eyes continued because a UN and African Union peacekeeping force large enough to stop the killing could not be put into place. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has been reduced to begging Sudanese leaders to stop the killing, but to no avail. Having lost the initial battle for creation of a world government structure during the debates leading up to the founding of the UN in 1945, the globalists created the World Federalist Movement in 1947 at the Conference of the World Movement for World Federal Government. The World Federalist ideologues set for themselves the task of penetrating the bureaucratic structures of the UN, co-opting the UN's internal processes toward global governance. and transforming the international body into a centerpiece cluster of international institutions that would lead to a world without borders, world citizenship, global taxes, universal gun control, global economic redistribution, and an international criminal court that could place individuals as subjects under its jurisdiction. Standing in the way of the globalist plans is the U.S. Constitution that makes some 300 million Americans the sovereigns of the state and enthrones the idea of individual liberty as the ultimate purpose of the United States. Hence, the first victim, if the globalist fantasies were realized, would be American liberty and the sovereignty of the state. Americans and others in the world would become slaves to an alien, faceless bureaucracy forever narrowing the boundaries of individual freedom. Non-governmental organizations, NGOs. The foot soldiers supporting world government ideologues are thousands of non-governmental organizations, most of which burst onto the world during the 1990s. These are the cutting edge essential to carrying out the left strategy of penetration, co-optation, and transformation of the UN into a center of world governance. Certainly, the UN is blessed by the large majority of NGOs that help to provide basic humanitarian services, from poverty programs to health assistance in troubled areas of the world. But these good NGOs are being trampled by those already having penetrated and co-opted many UN programs, and which are being used to transform the United Nations into a global citadel of world governance. A largely unreported phenomenon on the reform measures taken under the guidance of Secretary General Kofi Annan was the explosion in the number of NGOs, or civil society organizations, as they like to be called, and their direct participation in all areas of the United Nations. The Economic and Social Council, ECOSOC, granted consultative status to 41 NGOs in 1946, which reached 377 in 1968 and 700 in 1992. In January 2008, 3,052 NGOs enjoyed such standing, and 145 others were awaiting validation, which offers unprecedented access throughout the UN system to peddle their ideas. Once a UN office bites on a particular concept or project, the NGO can shop its UN interest item among thousands of funding sources in the philanthropic community. In a word, being a UN-approved non-governmental organization is a license to do business. It costs the UN nothing, and nation-state sovereignty is diluted a little bit with each UN-NGO action. This phenomenon is sometimes characterized by glittering generalities as the Global Associational Revolution and is cited as being a part of a universal movement of greater citizen action. In reality, it is all about lining the pockets of ostensible do-gooders. Senior UN officials offer lavish praise for the non-governmental organizations. Secretary General Kofi Annan, for example, addressed a UN-sponsored non-governmental organizations conference commemorating the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in September 1998. Describing the growth of the NGO as heartening, he noted that the UN is opening up, training our staff to work with NGOs and providing funding and other assistance to NGOs, particularly in the developing world. Secretary General Annan closed by saying that there is no turning back from the global NGO revolution. So let us move ahead in partnership. Louise Frechette, the Deputy Secretary General, gave a further elaboration of the view from the top echelons of the United Nations. There is a widening gap between what citizens demand and what governments can deliver. Our challenge is to bridge that gap. NGOs are the leading edge of civil society, who are bringing new life and meaning to the idea of an international community. With goodwill and reason, you are serving as the global conscience. The UN's strategic partnership with the NGOs is drawn from the mandate in the UN Charter to work with civil society. The international peace movement, led by the extreme left, has perverted the UN Charter by infringing upon, and sometimes supplanting, the role of national governments. Increasingly, the left-wing NGOs are hijacking the UN agenda and actively subverting the role and authority of sovereign nation-states. With their hands firmly on the throttles of the UN information system, the radical leftist leadership has built a global propaganda forum to prosecute its goal for world social transformation from the bottom up. When Antonio Gramsci's revisionist Marxism became popular among the left in the 1990s, the term civil society organization, which had used to portray the activities of political cultural centers against capitalist tyranny, mushroomed in popularity. civil society came to be seen as a means of Marxist renewal and re-emergence. After the Berlin Wall came down and citizens were empowered in Eastern Europe. Or, as Thomas Carruthers put it, civil society became a key element of the post-Cold War zeitgeist. The hard left began equating civil society organizations with non-governmental organizations. The civil society movement served as the engine of change in the United Nations and the point of the spear in undermining the place of sovereign nation-states. More than 3,000 NGOs enjoyed UN consultative status in 2008, most of which were dedicated to humanitarian relief, medical, faith-based, societal, educational, and other projects. Swimming among them like sharks, however, are strategic members of the Weiss Imperium and the broader global socialist community. Among these friends of the Weiss Imperium were the World Federation of Democratic Youth, Soviet Union Russia, World Council of Churches, World Federation of Trade Unions, Soviet Union Russia, Socialist International, Institute for Policy Studies and the Transnational Institute, Human Rights Watch, Global Exchange, American Civil Liberties Union, International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms, Peter Weiss, Peace Action, Cora Weiss, International Peace Bureau, Cora Weiss, World Federalist Movement, Peter Weiss, Open Society Institute, George Soros, and a lengthy list of others. These NGOs claim to represent civil society and use this propaganda device to help rationalize and shroud their activities inside the United Nations. Robert Huberty and David Riggs explain in a report for the Capital Research Center how these NGOs increasingly monopolize international meetings about the global future. They routinely reject the U.S. and other democratic governments in their activities in the free markets, free trade, and economic development, Huberty and Riggs explain. The left's NGOs peddle environmentalism, multiculturalism, wealth redistribution, disarmament, the abolition of nuclear weapons, elimination of trade in small arms, and a wealth of other social reconstruction topics. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan actively promoted the left's civil society organizations as a tool to undermine the role of the nation-state in UN activities. Annan asserted in 2000 that global affairs are no longer the exclusive province of foreign ministries, nor are states the sole source of solutions for our small planet's many problems, and added that many diverse and increasingly influential non-state actors have joined with national decision-makers to improvise new forms of global governance. Annan, in essence, raised the voice of the left's NGOs to the level of sovereign nation-states and, from their inside positions given to them by Annan in the UN General Assembly, their voices may be louder on global policy than the sovereign nation-states themselves. A 1998 General Assembly statement on strengthening of the United Nations system, for example, asserted that NGOs are the clearest manifestation of what is referred to as civil society, and opened the UN's inner doors to these external, unaccountable organizations if NGOs are to continue making a meaningful contribution to the work of the United Nations. It is crucial that their access to information and documentation be secured in a timely and appropriate manner. In a word, members of the General Assembly desire larger voices by NGOs inside the UN to help counter the sovereign authority of permanent members of the Security Council. And one may be certain that NGOs were behind the position taken by the General Assembly, guiding its members to support positions that would help the civil society organizations attract funding that would foster the UN sliding toward world governance. This course of events within the UN did not just happen willy-nilly. Rather, the World Federalist Movement, a front for the left, has been leading a campaign on behalf of strengthening the role of NGOs at the UN. Noting that the General Assembly has established a working group on extending NGO and citizen rights to all areas of the UN, the World Federalist Movement contends that these activities will help to democratize, reform, and strengthen the General Assembly, Women's Caucus, World Wildlife Fund, Greenpeace, Amnesty International, World Council of Churches, and other NGOs supporting the revised UN process. Reforming the UN from the inside to promote greater involvement of civil society, read NGOs, is only one of World Federalist Movement's activities. Its left-wing vision includes a commitment to a genuine world community where governments kowtow to global cooperation, democratic world institutions of law, A balance of the right to national self-determination with the collective rights of the global community, individuals as the rightful source and subject of the authority of world law. An end to the arms race and elimination of all weapons of mass destruction, termination of the use and threat of use of military force, a respect for universal human rights, and common environmental actions. For the World Federalist Movement, a global ethos and a consciousness of humanity as one community and of every person as a citizen of one world is an all-embracing theme. This vision envelopes Federalist Movement's work inside the UN system and was instrumental in successfully setting the stage for the May 1999 emergence of the Hague Appeal for Peace as a mammoth NGO, suitable for striking alliances with the moderate leftist non-governmental organizations. As a matter of fact, the Hague Appeal for Peace used the offices and network of the World Federalist Movement to advance socialist, Marxist, and peace causes within the UN system and worldwide. UN power brokers. Controlling the UN's powerful NGO activists are insiders, or power brokers, operating within the Secretary General's inner circle. Three senior advisors, shrouded in the shadows of the UN during Secretary General Kofi Annan's tenure, pushed the global governance transformation agenda. The points of the ultra-left spear in penetrating, co-opting, and transforming the United Nations were Maurice Strong, Jeffrey Sachs, and Cora Weiss. Maurice Strong cashed his chips from the UN's environmental program to its global governance transformation of the UN into a tool for undermining sovereignty and subverting the original intentions of the UN founders. Jeffrey Sachs promoted the scientific-based Millennium Project, which is said to promise an end world poverty over two decades through a huge redistribution of wealth from the rich countries of the North to the impoverished states in the South. Cora Weiss created a huge international peace corporation to promote world government and citizenship, transfer sovereignty from nation states to non-governmental organizations, and teach peace to children, read, propaganda worldwide. Each of these world government advocates used NGOs as their cutting tools to carry out the anti-nation state programs. Their efforts are underwritten by drawing resources from the UN and foundations that are open to funding approved United Nations initiatives. Maurice Strong, sometimes called an international man of mystery, preferred to work in the shadows of the UN. Strong was a senior advisor to the UN's Secretary General. Kofi Annan appointed him to transform the UN's sprawling worldwide structure toward a system of global governance. As a result of Strong's efforts, the sovereignty of the nation-state members have been slowly squeezed to make room for the socialist power of civil society organizations. A wealthy Canadian, Maurice Strong had been the indispensable man, journalist Ronald Bailey observed, at the center of this creeping UN power grab. Strong's first gig in the UN spotlight came when UN Secretary General Ufant appointed him to organize and conduct the first Earth Summit, the Stockholm Conference on the Human Environment. A year later, Strong was appointed director of the UN Environment Program. Strong's methodological march toward UN global governance had begun. At the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, UN Conference on the Environment and Development, Strong presented his perspective at the opening session. The concept of national sovereignty has been an immutable, indeed sacred, principle of international relations. It is a principle which will yield only slowly and reluctantly to the new imperative of global environmental cooperation. It is simply not feasible for sovereignty to be exercised unilaterally by individual nation-states, however powerful. The global community must be assured of environmental security. Strong has also been quoted as saying, "I am a socialist in ideology, a capitalist in methodology." Many members of Strong's family have been associated with communists and socialists, including a cousin who was a member of the Comintern. Strong was a confidant of former Soviet Communist Party head and leader of the Soviet Union Mikhail Gorbachev. They have been closely aligned for many years through solidarity of Strong's Earth Council and Gorbachev's Green Cross International. One would be wise to remember Strong's comments at the Rio meeting, "National sovereignty will yield only slowly to environmental security." On the capitalist side of the Maurice Strong Hydra head, one finds him to be a very successful businessman. He manipulated various areas of the energy sector to amass an ample fortune. He used a network of energy companies to gain sufficient control of activities to attract political notice, and then converted this attention into influencing political appointments. Strong took this basic model with him to the UN, where, using his own NGO as a hub, he could control the activities of several other NGOs that were favorably committed to UN global governance. Strong made certain that the right NGOs were funded by the UN or by the private foundations supporting the global governance agenda. Strong also served on the UN-funded Commission of Governance. In order to mask the underhanded transformation of the UN from an institution of nation-states dedicated to preserving human rights and peace to a world government of individuals, the phrase global governance reforms has been used. These reforms set into motion a slow rolling of the UN toward elimination of the veto power of the five permanent members of the Security Council, an independent menu of UN global taxation schemes, and the International Criminal Court, whereby the UN assumed direct control over individuals rather than follow its charter, making it an organ created by nation states and for nation states. Maurice Strong should be known as the Great Manipulator. His genius was found in creating networks of progressive and other left-wing-oriented individuals, UN offices and programs, and non-governmental organizations into a subtle mesh of political activity. The Janus-faced Maurice Strong applied his technique successfully in the capitalist arena to millions of dollars in wealth, and on the socialist side to moving the UN toward a position of global governance. The Volcker Report on oil for food transfers between the UN and Saddam Hussein's Iraq turned up amid 1997 check in Maurice Strong's name for $988,885. Drawn on a Jordanian bank, funded by Saddam Hussein, and delivered by a known UN-backed channel go-between with Saddam, Strong endorsed the check to invest in Cordex Petroleum, a Strong family-controlled business. Strong left the UN in the spring of 2005. Jeffrey Sachs, a professor at Columbia University, is another behind-the-curtains UN power broker. Sachs was appointed head of an independent advisory body, the Millennium Project, commissioned in 2002. The UN's flagship anti-poverty program, the Millennium Project, charged Sachs and his advisory body to develop an action plan that would lift the world's poor out of poverty, hunger, disease, and lack of shelter by 2015. And extreme poverty by 2025. More than a billion people live in poverty worldwide. In order to achieve the Millennium Project goals, an annual investment of about $110 per poor person would be needed. Sachs's final report was presented in January 2005 and, after review, was accepted. The Millennium Project's work was incorporated into the UN bureaucracy in 2007 to implement the recommended development strategies. According to Professor Sachs and members of his hand-selected advisory committee, the key to lifting impoverished areas out of poverty, disease, and hunger is through the creation of thousands of Millennium Villages, 60 of which were underway by early 2006 with private and corporate funding. The advisory body defined Millennium Development Goals as time-bound, quantified targets to aid in focusing resources and actions on major poverty factors. Most of the work is carried out by 10 thematic task forces, which are composed of more than 250 experts from around the world, NGO representatives, the private sector, the UN, International Monetary Fund, and World Bank. Sachs's Central, non-governmental organization for spreading United Nations resources to a multitude of non-governmental organizations in support of the Millennium Project, is the Earth Institute at Columbia University. These UN resources, if the Millennium Project estimates are correct, would amount to contributions to the project on the order of 0.7% of gross domestic product annually through 2015. For the United States, this massive redistribution of wealth would range from about $70 billion in 2003 to $140 billion in 2015. In the absence of good governance, it is unclear how these funds would be prevented from being diverted into the pockets of dictators and their supporters. The steep rise in food and energy prices in mid-2008, however, rocked the momentum of progress toward the Millennium Project goals. The dramatic price increases threatened to erase the 7 years of progress toward reducing poverty in thousands of Millennium Villages. Joseph Klein, in Global Deception, placed his finger on the pulse of the UN's stealth assault on America's freedom. Labeling the Secretary General's special advisors Maurice Strong and Jeffrey Sachs as leaders of the globalist brigade, Klein explains how NGOs, accountable to no one, are being used to trample and subvert the concept of state sovereignty inside the UN and in ways that supersede the US Constitution. The International Criminal Court, for instance, is postured above the American Constitution and individual freedom. Meanwhile, Sachs is using NGOs in much the same way to subvert sovereignty through a massive redistribution of wealth, which reaches UN targets through NGOs. A third coat hanger in the UN's shadowy deep closet is reserved for the international peace movement, with special wings extended to the human rights and global governance agendas as well. Cora Weiss, a grandmother in the shadows, and her husband, Peter Weiss, are the creators of the Hague Appeal for Peace. They serve as president and chief executive officer of this large, left-wing, multinational enterprise. Cora Weiss is both a principal organizer and strategist for radical and moderate socialists, Marxists, and peace and human rights activists, operating behind the facade of the Hague Appeal for Peace and other front organizations. She shows a multitude of public faces. From the 1960s until the end of the 1980s, many publications indicated that Cora Weiss participated actively in several ultra-left front activities. She headed and co-founded Women's Strike for Peace, helped bring about the end of atmospheric nuclear testing, and served as a delegate to the World Congress of Women held in Prague, Czechoslovakia, in 1981. She played a pivotal role in getting a host of front organizations and allied non-socialist NGOs to protest the war in Vietnam, helping organize anti-war demonstrations, including the largest one on November 15, L969. In Washington, D.C., Cora Weiss served as co-chair and director of the Committee of Liaison with the Families of Prisoners Detained in Vietnam. The FBI investigated the committee from 1970 to 1973, which was alleged to be a vehicle of North Vietnamese propaganda whose activities were believed to be detrimental to the health and welfare of the prisoners held in North Vietnam. David Horowitz placed this particular front organization and Cora Weiss's activities into a proper perspective. Joan Baez took out a full-page ad in the New York Times for an appeal to the conscience of North Vietnam. She enlisted a number of former anti-war activists to sign her call to the communists to show more humanity in their treatment of their opponents. As soon as her statement appeared, however, Baez was attacked by Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda as a tool of the CIA. A counter-ad was organized by Cora Weiss, who had traveled to Hanoi and collaborated with the regime in its torture of American POWs. The Weiss had praised the communists for their moderation in administering the peace. Cora Weiss has a long record of support for the United Nations, starting in the 1950s when she hosted petitioners seeking their independence in colonial Africa. Weiss was the co-initiator of the Women's Peace Petition to the UN General Assembly calling for a transfer of 5% of all military budgets a year for 5 years to support sustainable development and programs for women's empowerment. Cora Weiss and the late Richard Barnett, also a Council on Foreign Relations member, were among the principal IPS associates who made the Jane Fonda-Tom Hayden pilgrimage to Hanoi to confer with the North Vietnamese Communist government. Mrs. Weiss also was a prominent figure in the People's Coalition for Peace and Justice, PCBJ, leading demonstrations and lobbying efforts for PCBJ on specific peace campaigns, including People's Peace Treaty, Citizens Action Pledge, and Nixon Eviction Campaign. She was one of the brains behind resolutions pertaining to the Assembly for Peace and Independence of the People of Indochina held at Versailles, France, in February 1972. Weiss has maintained close alliances with religious groups working on peace issues, such as clergy and laity concerned about Vietnam, the World Council of Churches, and the Interfaith Council. In 1985, she was a delegate of the World Council of Churches to the Third International Conference on Women, Decade of Women in Nairobi, and as a delegate to the Beijing Conference on Women in August 1995. At these fora, she often spoke on war, conflicts and prevention, and alternatives to violence. As president of the 1999 Hague Appeal for Peace, Cora Weiss launched a large civil society NGO movement, which she has helped build during her many years of dedication to radical socialist, Marxist, and peace activist causes. Cora Weiss is also a principal officer of the International Peace Bureau, vice president of the steering committee in the International Peace Brigade 1997 to 2000, and other front organizations of the left. Just like his wife, Peter Weiss presents a chameleon-like profile. With the dissolution of the Soviet Union, he adopted a new image as a progressive fighting for human rights, disarmament, and world peace. His associations with like-minded persons extend worldwide, from the Socialist Democratic Party in the United States to the African National Congress in South Africa, and from the Liberation Movement in Burma to the National Congress in the Netherlands. Peter Weiss has a long association with the National Lawyers Guild, a radical lawyers' association organized in 1936 with the assistance of lawyers from the Communist Party, USA, and he served on the Board of Trustees. The National Lawyers Guild has handled important cases against the U.S. intelligence agencies, represented the late CIA deserter Philip Agee's interests, and often supported groups involved with foreign terrorist and resistance movements, ranging from members of the Bader-Meinhof gang to the Puerto Rican Socialist Party. The National Lawyers Guild is the U.S. section of the Soviet-Russian International Association of Democratic Lawyers, IDL. For some 15 years, Peter Weiss has been a leader of the Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR. The center was founded in 1966 by three leaders of the National Lawyers Guild, William Kunstler, Morton Stavis, and Arthur Kinoe. Also giving a hand were the late Ben Smith, a registered agent of the Cuban government, and Peter Weiss. The CCR represented the family of Charles Horman, who was murdered in Chile shortly after the Pinochet coup, in their suit against Henry Kissinger and other high officials of the U.S. government. When the center defended Puerto Rican Socialist Party member Delfin Ramos, who was charged with possession of stolen explosives, the center defense team stated that they were representing Ramos in such a way as to not only expose the government's political motivations for the prosecution, but to reveal the oppressive nature of the colonial relationship. The center also instituted legal suits designed to help the guerrillas of El Salvador and the Cuban government and published material from the Sandinistas of Nicaragua. One of the articles published in the center's newsletter, Fight the Right, in May 1981, was titled Reagan's Reign of Terror, a socialist manifesto for the early 21st century. When the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, the extremist left wing was left stranded like a small boat on a Marxist sandbar as the Soviet Union was swept away with the receding tide. Left-wing activists occupied themselves with continued agitation and propaganda against the West, including anti-nuclear, anti-apartheid, anti-arms trade, licit and illicit, anti-U.S. bases in the Philippines, anti-Gulf War, and anti-U.S. activities in Central America. They also critiqued NATO's new strategic concept, drew dire fictitious scenarios about the U.S. military concept of low-intensity warfare, and pursued similar themes that would lead to abolishing war. Yet, the left in the early 1990s, both leadership and rank and file alike, seemed to lack the fire in the belly quality that had marked their anti-heyday during the Cold War. For them, the first half of the 1990s was spent mostly in the wilderness, trying first to come to grips with the realization that the promised communist revolution would not occur, or it not in the manner that the leadership had promised, and secondly, to determine the course of their future activism on behalf of Marxist renewal and reemergence through the international peace movement. The left wing, especially the radical socialists, Marxists, and peace activists, faced an identity crisis. Among themselves, they wailed like an off-key choir about how to distinguish themselves from liberals, their natural allies, but always at some distance, and conservatives. Since calling themselves socialists is regarded as counterproductive in the United States because of McCarthyist hyperbole in the 1950s against communism and the international socialist movement, some leftists began calling themselves social democrats, others progressives, and for many social progressives. They unabashedly used McCarthy's ghost to their advantage by shutting off debate on their support for radical causes, often attacking critics as being guilty of McCarthyism. Within this search for identity, however, there occurred new thinking about reorienting the socialist culture of political activism worldwide. While the collapse of the Soviet Union and socialism in several other countries seemed to negate most of what the radical left had believed, they dismissed the idea that these events had any real meaning for the revolutionary future. For the extreme leftists, it was only actually existing socialism that had failed, David Horowitz explains. Real socialism had not yet been tried. Socialism, it was still the name of their desire. Horowitz continues that, since the leftists are revolutionaries in their drive toward creating a dreamed of future that remains unaffected by current events, they can live comfortably in a reality that has been rejected by new objective conditions. Meanwhile, the radical politics of social transformation, created by Marxist and socialist professors at American universities, flew in the face of recent history that documented the repressive and bloody actions of regimes of the Soviet-led communist world. The international peace movement's search for new issues in the mainline of global human events first bore fruit in the highly successful campaign against landmines. Organized into non-governmental organizations worldwide, their political activism hit national governments unprepared for the resulting sustained public support for a global landmine ban. Combining centralized control by an elite NGO board of directors dominated by the left and decentralized execution by supporting NGOs, this action team was joined by a wide range of government officials from the United Nations, the European Union, EU, and national governments, as well as by persons of world stature such as the late beloved Princess Diana and others. The campaign against landmines also served as a pilot project for a new NGO multinational enterprise, one that would drive the left-wing bandwagon into the new millennium. By 1999, the left-wing could be seen as having emerged from their years in the wilderness and actively going about the business of restoring or strengthening the international peace movement. Likewise, coalitions were reinforced with labor unions, national liberation movements, faith-based organizations, and a host of specialized activist organizations on issues of human rights, refugees, and displaced persons. Economic development, conventional and nuclear weapons disarmament, conflict prevention, peacekeeping, humanitarian aid, minority programs, women's and children's issues, and others involved in nonviolent conflict resolution. Peter Weiss is a regular visitor to the UN and participates in many of its panel discussions. These can be seen as nurturing sessions, a presence to ensure continued radical leftist penetration at the world body. In cooperation with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, Cora Weiss took the lead on the formation of the Hague Appeal for Peace, which combines and integrates UN global governance, world citizenship, and human rights, and international peace. In response to an appeal by four NGOs of the radical left, International Peace Bureau, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms, ILANA, and the World Federalist Movement, nearly 10,000 activists, government representatives, and community leaders from more than 100 countries attended a May 11th to 15th, 1999, conference at The Hague. In reality, the Hague Appeal for Peace was a celebration and launching pad for a new multinational corporation for hundreds of non-governmental organizations. Some 400 panels, workshops, and roundtables served as forums for conference attendees to discuss and debate mechanisms for abolishing war and creating a culture of peace in the 21st century. The Hague Appeal, dominated by radical leftists masquerading as social progressives, advocated the creation of new partnerships between citizens, governments, and international organizations that will help make us progress toward peace. In reality, it is old wine in new bottles, as the traditional anti-West, anti-US rhetoric espoused by the left has been dressed for respectability in the post-Cold War order. Growing clout inside the UN and EU with regard to a range of left-wing policies and advocacy programs provide the proponents an air of social acceptance in their use of UN, EU, and national government monies, mostly provided by North America and Western Europe. Peter Weiss clearly stated the purpose of the international peace movement. The sole purpose of the Hague Appeal is to send a clear message to the world's policymakers on how to eliminate the causes of war, including racism, colonialism, poverty, and other human rights violations. The limitation of arsenals to a reasonable level for territorial defense, the elimination of all weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear ones, the establishment and utilization of conflict resolution mechanisms as an interim measure on the way to abolish war, improvements in humanitarian law, and most importantly, the creation of a culture of peace for the world's war-oppressed people. Among the speakers at the Hague gathering in May 1999 were Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the UN, Nolene Heiser, Executive Director of the UN Development Fund for Women, Carol Bellamy, Executive Director of the UN Children's Fund, Judge Christopher Weirmentree, Vice President of the International Court of Justice, Jody Williams, International Ambassador for the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, Josias van Aarten, Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Netherlands, Pierre Skouri, Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs, Sweden, David Andrews, T.D., Minister for Foreign Affairs, Ireland, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and H.M. Queen Noor of Jordan, Jimmy Carter, Nelson Mandela, and other notables sent messages of support. The Hague Appeal for Peace, the name of the new NGO multinational corporation, was heralded by its organizers as a great success. This new activist enterprise is organized into 7 major product or operating departments. These corporate directorates are mutually supporting and responsible to the president/chief executive office and a board of directors for all operations. Decentralized execution by independent NGOs participating in alliances and caucuses on specific regions or issues is emphasized along policy lines prescribed by the Hague Appeal for Peace. Since the Hague Appeal is often the direct source, pass-through source, or approving authority for donors contributing funds to the participating independents, centralized control over the multitude of NGOs is assured. The Hague Agenda for Peace and Justice for the 21st Century, a document distributed during the May 1999 conference, represents what should be called a socialist manifesto for the early 21st century. This manifesto, which is also distributed as a UN document, represents what the NGOs and individuals associated with the international peace movement consider to be some of the most important challenges facing humankind. Its basic premise underwrites a socialist action plan to undermine and destroy the sovereign nation-state as the source of the UN's international legitimacy that is astonishingly candid. In a great many cases, the world's governments have manifestly failed to fulfill their responsibility to prevent conflict, protect civilians, end war, eradicate colonialism, guarantee human rights, and create the conditions of permanent peace. Therefore, this historic mission and responsibility cannot be trusted to governments. A key proposition in the contemporary socialist manifesto is making human security a centerpiece in its action plan. By drawing on international humanitarian and human rights law to reinforce the basic premise that governments cannot be trusted to prevent war, leftists redefine security in terms of human needs. Finally, they pose small arms as a threat to human security, which makes it an acceptable subject for concentrated attention by the UN and its civil society partners, NGOs, as well as the European Union. Extending an olive branch to faith-based NGOs and international labor ensures a unity of effort under the guiding hands of Cora and Peter Weiss, the creators of the Hague Appeal for Peace. The Hague Appeal for Peace, as an umbrella multinational enterprise, conducts its day-to-day operations through 4 activist NGOs: World Federalist Movement, International Peace Bureau, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms. These action centers maintain alliances with numerous international front NGOs, supporting the International Socialist Manifesto. As a co-sponsor of the 1999 Hague Appeal for Peace, the World Federalist Movement, WFM, focused on its long-standing goals of creating lasting peace, preventing conflicts, and protecting civilians. The purpose of the WFM from its 1947 founding has been to transfer the Charter and the UN into a democratic legal order capable of preventing war and enforcing peace. The resulting world federalism would make it possible to reduce the size of armed forces and promote a transfer of political power and responsibilities to the most appropriate levels of government. The World Federalists also support the creation of global structures that are accountable to the citizens of the world. The World Federalist Movement's William R. Pace served as Secretary General of the Hague Appeal for Peace at its May 1999 founding. He spoke eloquently, saying that one of our main goals was to prevent future wars. He said, "Global civil society is demanding new approaches, citizen-based, bottom-up, alternative strategies for peace, early warning, and conflict prevention." Another co-convener of the Hague Appeal for Peace was the International Peace Bureau. This NGO was founded in 1892 and has always been critical of the way in which both the League of Nations and the United Nations have been manipulated by the most powerful states and interests. It has 170 member organizations and groups in more than 40 countries. The IPB focuses on supporting the peace and disarmament initiatives taken by the UN and devotes most of its resources to informing and assisting grassroots peace campaigns. Cora Weiss served as a vice president and member of the IPB steering committee. The Cora Weiss-led Samuel Rubin Foundation has also been an institutional donor. The IPB plays a central role in the Geneva-based Special NGO Committee for Disarmament. Governments are far too much in the pockets of the military, Colin Archer, Secretary General of the International Peace Bureau in Geneva, is quoted as having said at the Hague Appeal for Peace inaugural. They're not necessarily accountable to the people. Millions of people around the world don't have drinking water, but in many countries where military spending is up, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, IPNW, a third action center for the Socialist Manifesto, is a federation of national medical organizations in 58 countries, representing tens of thousands of doctors, medical students, other health workers, and concerned citizens who share a common goal of creating a more peaceful and secure world freed from the threat of nuclear annihilation. To that end, IPNW members educate the public and organize demonstrations against government policies. A fourth activist group, the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms, ILANA, was created in 1988 with the aim of preventing nuclear war through international disarmament and conflict resolution mechanisms. As a co-initiator of the Hague Appeal for Peace, ILANA has been deeply involved in its efforts to define mechanisms for abolishing war and creating a culture of peace. ILANA continues its pivotal role in this peace campaign and successful coalition of hundreds of supporting NGOs. Seven main actions initiated by the Hague Appeal for Peace in support of the United Nations included measures to restrict possession and trade of small arms, establish an international criminal court, entered into force on July 1, 2002, ban landmines, abolish nuclear weapons, eliminate social and economic injustice to prevent war, stop the use of child soldiers, and conduct a global campaign for peace education, which in reality is socialist propaganda and disinformation. Peace movement. Like warriors in the midst of a rainforest, the reinvented left-wing international peace movement in 1999 began launching new volleys of poisonous arrows at Western policymakers from the shadows of a mammoth multinational front. The Hague Appeal for Peace. This NGO multinational launched in May 1999 masks permanent political activism inside the United Nations to fashion political actions against the capitalist West. The Hague Appeal's plan of action, due largely to vigorous left-wing activism inside the UN system, has been aligned with the UN agenda and has crosswalks to the progressive socialist Marxist movements in North America and Europe and the Japanese peace movement. Yoko Furuyama, representing Peace Boat Japan at the 1999 Hague Appeal for Peace, committed the Japanese to making two around-the-world cruises to spread the word about the Hague Appeal's discussions and identification of peace and human rights issues for all humankind. When an ocean-going peace ship travels to a troubled place, people gather on land or on board to discuss issues of peace and local initiatives. The peace boat tries to bring these voices to meetings with international institutions to help activists better understand the issue at hand. It is important for the Japanese peacemakers to take the initiative before a war starts in order to prevent war. Japan has been organizing such peace cruises since 1983. As a collateral effort, the Japanese say that since they have a big ship, they also carry relief goods. They also carry handicrafts and sell them at the follow-on ports of call to support the sustainable development of the people. More than 60 peace voyages had been made by January 2008. The peace boat traveled to more than 100 ports in over 80 countries. Chartered passenger ships provide open spaces that are used to accommodate peace discussions with about 50 guest educators aboard ship from across the globe. Educational activities include peace education workshops and lectures, plus language and cultural programs. The peace program is oriented to contemporary issues affecting the countries visited as well as expert discussion of global issues. The Japanese also offered open forums on peace boat voyages around the world. The peace boat offers a neutral space for networking between groups that share common concerns, especially those civil society groups that are unable to convene or participate in major international conferences. In September 2007, Peace Boat began collaborating with Mayors for Peace campaign to call on city executives around the world for their solidarity for and participation in global action toward the abolition of nuclear weapons. The 59th Global Voyage for Peace in September 2007 collaborated with mayors' offices all along the voyage route. This program began in 1982 when the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki called upon municipal leaders around the world to join them in their anti-nuclear efforts. In January 2008, more than 2,000 mayors in nearly 200 cities worldwide had supported the peace program. Organizers announced their 7th General Conference of Mayor for Peace in 2009 would be held in Nagasaki, where they hoped to strengthen their relationship with other non-governmental organizations and raise the public demand for nuclear abolition. Cora Weiss's Global Campaign for Peace Education is in the process of creating a Peace Boat U.S. similar to Peace Boat, Japan. She has tied the Hague Appeal's propaganda and disinformation to Article 9 of Japan's Constitution. Written by America at the end of World War II, Article 9 simply renounces the right to wage war and to maintain armed forces for that purpose. Hence, the Peace Boat U.S., dedicated to building a culture of peace around the world, has adopted a global Article 9 campaign to abolish war. Peace Boat U.S. is a tax-free organization founded in 2006. Its purpose is to extend the Peace Boat experience developed by Japan to English-speaking individuals. Peace Boat U.S. is a floating peace education campaign. Much like the Japanese peace program, people of all ages at ports of call will be brought on board to receive the hotbed propaganda drawn from the bowels of the Hague Appeal for Peace. The Peace Boat U.S. people depict pleasant propaganda pictures of activists simply standing with their fingers interlaced, smiling, and with imaginary halos over their heads. Peace Boat U.S. is working to promote peace, human rights, equitable and sustainable development, and respect from the environment throughout the United States and the world. Who can stand opposed to such a simple statement of purpose? The Hague Appeal for Peace also set into motion a global campaign for peace education. The initiative insists that peace education be made compulsory at all levels of the education system and demands that education ministries systematically implement peace education initiatives at a local and national level. The campaign is being carried out through a global network of educational associations and regional, national, and local task forces of citizens and educators. Cora Weiss, president of the Hague Appeal for Peace, in a June 1999 speech at St. Petersburg, Russia, billed the meeting at The Hague as the biggest peace conference of its kind. This civil society initiative, she said, brought together nearly 10,000 people from national governments, international governmental organizations, NGOs, and leaders of other civic entities. Noting that small arms are a big problem, Mrs. Weiss added that eliminating small arms, from pistols to rifles, is just as the first step toward the abolition of slavery was the abolition of the slave trade. So the first step toward the abolition of excessive national arsenals should be abolition of the arms trade. The traditional far-left peace propaganda continued to pour forth from the Hague Appeal for Peace on behalf of the United Nations. Cora Weiss addressed the 4th European Congress for Peace Education in Hamburg, Germany in June 2003, ostensibly to talk education, but in reality took a tried-and-true anti-United States propaganda line. She saluted the assembled peace educators, emphasizing the importance of their help to shape the minds and the direction of every future inhabitant on Earth. Mrs. Weiss asked rhetorically, why are British and American soldiers in Iraq? Why did the US and UK invade Iraq if the Security Council didn't say it was okay? Where are the weapons of mass destruction that posed an imminent threat to warrant war? She advocated that we need to teach the importance of a strengthened United Nations. We need human security, not national security. This theme underlies the anti-nation state agenda of the radical left to lead the world towards socialist governance. The Hague Appeal for Peace also offers a peace educator's kit, learning to abolish war, teaching toward a culture of peace, underscoring the key propaganda and disinformation points to be used in addressing elementary, middle grade, and secondary schools in the United States and throughout the world. Elementary grades 4 to 6 should be guided to understand that peace is, and a culture of peace will be, the consequence of efforts of individuals and groups committed to making peace by personal actions and cooperative efforts. Civil society, read, NGOs, is made up of such individuals and groups. The middle grades 6 to 9, a violent survey is called for to give an overview of the state of the world, to begin learning the ways peace and what is needed to develop a culture of peace. Students need to understand the culture of violence and how it affects our lives. And for the secondary grades 8 to 12, CORE's vision explains, peace educators have long understood the need to cultivate the moral imagination of learners, so as to enable them to see peace as an actual condition of a preferred and possible future. The educational task then becomes the designing and imparting of the learning required to bring about the changes that can make the possible a probable one. French professor Jacques Ellul's central thesis in Propaganda, The Formation of Men's Attitudes, was that modern propaganda could not work without education, or, more accurately, pre-propaganda. According to Professor Ellul, education conditions the mind with vast amounts of incoherent information. Follow-up propaganda and disinformation give coherence to the collective of incoherent information in ways that are consistent with the communicator's intentions. When reviewing the Global Campaign for Peace Education by the Hague Appeal for Peace, it is quite evident that learning to abolish war, teaching a culture of peace, is about neither. Rather, the education program is but a pre-propaganda campaign for a flood of selected truths and blatant lies, disinformation. Hundreds of non-governmental organizations are involved in multiple aspects of the Hague Appeal have endorsed the Global Campaign for Peace Education. War is bad. Peace is good. Everyone agrees. But when these statements are placed into selected local contexts, they become tools for propaganda and disinformation. While propaganda and education are obviously related in terms of the general process of opinion formation, Professor Terence H. Qualter argued persuasively that the very essence of the distinction between propaganda and education is the deliberate nature of propaganda. To put it in a simple direct sentence, the purpose of propaganda is to control actions by influencing attitudes. The deliberate attempt by Cora Weiss and the global network of peace educators supporting her are taking advantage of students by helping to form, control, or alter their attitudes and take the actions desired by the UN Culture of Peace program. This is evidence of propaganda, not education. Cora Weiss, a long-standing icon of the radical left, has keenly used the common ground between education and propaganda to hide in plain sight a universal UN-sponsored peace propaganda campaign. The UN peace propaganda program is not only run by a coalition of anti-war activists, but it is sharply focused against the United States. As shown in Cora Weiss's comments in Hamburg, Germany, the educational materials served up by the Hague Appeal for Peace on behalf of the UN do not address the concepts of sovereignty, individual freedom, democracies being answerable to their own citizens, and other topics essential explained to a real culture of peace. Readers are not told that the first casualty of a culture of peace would be individual liberty, nor are readers informed about how a culture of peace would open social spaces in terms of Gramsci's revisionist Marxism to be filled by revolutionary socialists. Secretary General Kofi Annan found a way to work around the grand ideals of the United Nations founders, and perhaps even the letter of the UN founding documents, to put the UN on a path of global governance. Using a shadowy clique of back channel of advisors, the Secretary General placed the UN in opposition to the sovereign authority of nation states, not only the five permanent members of the Security Council, but those in General Assembly as well. These advisors, Maurice Strong, Jeffrey Sachs, and Cora Weiss, not only drew upon UN resources to advance the global governance agenda, but they successfully obtained money for UN efforts from progressive governments, foundations, in the business community. The key to opening the treasure chest of donor dollars was through a pipeline created by so-called civil society organizations, or more accurately non-governmental organizations. Like voracious Formosan termites, these ultra-left NGOs were enabled by the UN back channel by seeking donor funds for the UN projects they were associated with. There could be no global governance, millennium anti-poverty, or anti-war propaganda campaign without external funding. The goal is to engage more and more of the so-called civil society organizations to dilute the authority of sovereign nation-states inside the UN. These Gramscian grand tactics of subversion have set the UN on a pathway to creating a world without borders, global citizenship, and a faceless international bureaucracy towering over the very countries responsible for its creation. Death of the nation-state. The slippage from state sovereignty to a world socialist governance will happen quietly and without fanfare. One day Americans may well awaken to find the Declaration of Independence has been amended to delete any transcendental reference of being endowed by their creator, the Bill of Rights restructured to accommodate multicultural changes, and the Constitution cast aside as being outdated and irrelevant. All of this will occur to make room for the United Nations, or some such global entity, to guide us through socialist world governance, a world without borders. It is just such a conspiracy against the American electorate and government that the progressive socialist Marxists have in mind. Follow Gramsci's formula. Change the culture, destroy Christianity, undermine popular appreciation of American heritage, slip into power through the ballot box, consolidate their political position, and begin the slide toward world socialist governance through a co-opted United Nations. The latter becomes facilitated by world-embracing peace, human rights, and environmental, human rights, and peace movements headed by the Hague Appeal for Peace, the grandmother of the Institute for Policy Studies.